everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the show all about books that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week we're getting ready for Christmas. Naturalist and author Stephen Moss reveals some fascinating facts about that favourite symbol of Christmas, the robin.
Someone had the bright idea of putting a picture of a robin on a card and marketing it as a Christmas card.
I talk tech with Connect Radio's resident expert, Stephen Scott, and discover the best way to listen to my favourite talking books.
You can search for books based on genre, you can search for books based on title or your favourite author.
Robert Kirkwood plucks 10 of the best Christmas stories from the RNIB library, and actor and comedian Eddie Izzard tells us what inspired him to narrate his first audiobook, Lost Christmas.
I'm dyslexic, so I'm a slow reader. And a great way to read, have to read a book is if you do an audiobook.
That's all coming up in today's show. Stephen Moss is a naturalist and author. His latest book, The Robin, a biography, reveals some interesting facts about Britain's favourite bird. He joined me down the line from Bath Spa University to tell me more. So, Stephen Moss, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much, Red.
So the book's full of fascinating facts about the robin. For instance, I never realised that the name Robin is actually a nickname.
Yes, I think that's one of the oddest things. I'm actually writing a book at the moment about bird names, and that's one of the things that came up when I was doing the research for that, which is that when, for example, my grandmother was bringing me up, she used to talk about Jenny Wren, Robin Redbreast, Tom Tit, you know, little nicknames for birds. And it was only later that it occurred to me that it's a bit like as if we were calling all wrens a Jenny, because Robin is actually the nickname. Redbreast was the original name. And in fact, there's a name even older than that, Ruddock, which means red little bird, a bit like Dunnock for brown little bird. So, yeah, Robin is basically a nickname.
And, of course, the robin doesn't have a particularly red breast. It's more orange, isn't it?
Well, I think so. I have to say, my wife disagrees with this. She said, well, of course it's red, but we do see colours differently, all of us. But to me, it's orange-red or reddish-orange. And, of course, the reason for this, it's not called Robin Orange Breast, apart from the fact it's not alliterative and doesn't really scan. The main reason is that when the robin was called Red Breast back in the 13th, 14th century and possibly even earlier, the colour orange didn't actually exist in the sense that it was considered a shade of red. It was only when oranges began to be imported from southern Europe into Britain in the 14th, 15th, 16th centuries that people started adopting the name orange, which was the name of the fruit, for the colour that we now know as orange.
Ah, right, OK. So it's as recent as that.
Yeah, so it's a bit like, you know, it's like light green and light blue don't really have their own names, do they? But orange does, but it's really a sort of pale red.
And where did the link between the robin and Christmas come from?
I think there's two reasons for this. The obvious reason is that robins are very tame in winter. Robins are largely insectivorous birds. So they eat insects, they eat invertebrates, mostly from the soil or the grass. So you see them hopping around your lawn or your flower bed. And in winter, particularly in the old days when there was a lot of ice and snow in winter just coming up to Christmas, which there isn't much now, but robins would come to the back doorstep looking for food, and people would give food, perhaps scraps of bread or a little bit of lard or something to them. And so they became associated with that season. And of course, they are a bird that's around in our gardens in winter. Then what happened was when the first penny post started in 1840, the first postmen wore red uniforms and were nicknamed robins. And someone had the bright idea of putting a picture of a robin on a card and marketing it as a Christmas card. This was a new thing because, of course, before then you couldn't post cards, so people didn't really give cards to each other. So robins were put on Christmas cards, and they often had a little letter in their beak, and the idea was they were representing the postman.
And the book brims over with fascinating facts. It's a real, well, it's a magpie's delight as far as... but the other fact I hadn't realised is just how British this love of robins is, and that's closely linked to us not having wild boars in our woods.
That's right. We do now, of course, in a few woods like the Forest of Dean and the Ashdown Forest, we've got wild boars. But for over 500 years, there were no wild boars in Britain. Now, if you go to the continent and you talk to people there, they see robins. I've seen robins in Spain and France, but they're usually in woods. They're not normally, well, they don't have as many gardens as us, but they're a bird of woodland. They're quite a shy bird. And in ancient times, and still now in places like France, robins would follow wild boars around because, as you know, wild boars dig up the soil with those fearsome tusks, and they're always turning over earth in forests. And of course, that allows the robin to find food. Now, when robins are in Britain, they don't have wild boars, so they started following us around, and particularly probably 100 or so years ago when gardening started to become very popular. You'd find that when you were digging up the soil, a robin would turn up next to you, and you think, oh, isn't that lovely? What a lovely little bird. It's so affectionate and friendly. Well, it is, but it's only affectionate and friendly. It's what, again, my mum would have called cupboard love. It basically wants the food you're unearthing. So you turn over the soil, it nips down and grabs a worm, sits on your spade, everyone's happy. But actually, it's exploiting us.
And obviously very successfully, because you say there are 6 million mating pairs within the UK?
Yes, roughly. It's always hard to estimate, but that's the general estimate. And that makes it Britain's second commonest bird. Now, can you guess? Well, you've probably read the book, but I bet if I'd asked you before you read the book, you wouldn't know what our commonest bird is.
I believe it's the wren, isn't it?
It is the wren, yeah, with about 10 million pairs in Britain and Ireland, probably about 8 million in Britain. Now, people never believe that.
And yet I wouldn't recognise, well, I can't see, but I wouldn't have recognised a wren when I could see, and yet a robin is instantly recognisable to us all.
Yes, what you would recognise of the wren is its song, of course. The wren has this wonderfully loud song. It's probably the loudest song of any tiny British bird. It's a very small bird, only weighs about 8-10 grams, which is about, you know, third of an ounce. And yet it has incredibly loud song with what my friend Dominic Cousins, a fellow nature writer, calls the twiddle in the middle. And he always says that a wren reminds him of an opera diva giving her all in the last act, because they really do sing very loudly and with great energy. So if you hear that song, listen to that song, and you'll hear that all over the place, even around now, even in winter you hear them.
You mentioned how small the wren is, but the robin isn't much bigger. You said roughly the same weight as two new £1 coins.
Yeah, I think it's about 12 grams, a robin, 12, 15 grams. It's not very big. You know, you get quite a few for a quarter of sweets. It's a pretty small bird, but all songbirds are. You know, they're small and light because they need to fly. A mammal of the same size would be 3 or 4 times the weight, because, of course, it doesn't need to get airborne. So it's like all small birds, robins have very delicate wings, hollow bones, you know, so they're able to get airborne.
One of the great pleasures throughout the year is hearing robins, usually in my case, singing on lampposts. They're fiercely territorial, and what I hadn't realised is that both male and female robins are territorial and both sing.
Yes, that's very unusual. Amongst British birds, the robin's really the only bird where the female regularly holds territory and sings. All the others, it's the male bird singing. And the other unusual thing about robins is they hold territory, different territories sometimes, smaller ones, but they hold them all year round. So the male and female, the male will hold the territory in the spring and summer, the female will breed with him, and then in autumn they will split up, and she will sometimes actually fly all the way over to France or Spain, or she may just fly a little bit further away, and she will find a small territory and she will defend it by singing. And it's probably all about food. Most things in nature are about food. But that means that you do hear robins throughout the year. You also, as you mentioned, hear them at night. Now, this is, again, for two reasons. One is robins have taken very well to cities and towns where there are streetlights, but they also have very good sight. They have these big black eyes, beady eyes, and that means that they are able to see earlier in the morning and later at night than other birds. So you often hear a robin first thing in the dawn chorus. But what also happens now is robins get woken up at night by the streetlights come on. The robin's woken up, it starts singing, and next door, because their territories are so tiny in cities, the next male robin starts singing, and it's a bit like a sort of arms race or you know, a set of dominoes. Once one starts singing, the other one can't resist because he's worried about defending his territory. And so, of course, you do get robins singing at night, and people then think they're nightingales because, of course, as you know, the nightingale's the only bird that sings at night, except it isn't.
But they are the same family.
They are, yes. Yeah, they are. Robins are funny. They're the only bird now in their genus. There's lots of birds around the world called robin or robin chat, lots of birds with robin in their name. Some of them are closely or distantly related to robins. They're chats, as we call them, like little miniature thrushes. But an awful lot of them aren't. The one in America, the American robin, is basically a big beefy thrush, a bit like very closely related to our blackbird, but with a sort of orangey, rusty breast. And basically, the Pilgrim Fathers went over there. Someone was homesick. They saw a bird with a reddish breast, called it a robin.
So is this love of the robin only a British and expat thing, or would you find robins being as popular in China or Asia or whatever?
Not at all. No, culturally, it's a very British thing. The Americans love their robin. In fact, recently they decided in America to change all the names of all the birds called robin to thrush, because they are all thrushes. And the one they wouldn't change was American robin, because they felt that with the cultural associations, you know, Michael Jackson's song Rockin' Robin, or the old song, When the Rob, Rob, Robin Comes Bob, Bob, Bobbing Along. And that's, you know, they love their robins as well, but it's a different species. So, no, our robin, if you go to the continent, people know it and they like it, but it's no different from perhaps a stone chat or a black red start or a red star or these other very beautiful birds in that family. But it's not considered culturally special as our robin is.
You're obviously a very keen ornithologist. Or birdwatcher? I don't know.
Birdwatcher. I suppose I am an ornithologist. I'm not a trained ornithologist because I'm not a scientist. And to be honest, I'm equally interested in the cultural side of birds. So the robin, a biography, as we called it, is actually, I suppose, half of it is science and my own observations, and the other half is the culture of robins, because I just find that side of birds endlessly fascinating.
And robins have a habit of making nests in some very bizarre places.
Yeah, I think of all birds, they're probably the weirdest in terms of that. I mean, they nest in mostly they'll nest in sort of shrubbery, hedgerows, things like honeysuckle, clematis. You know, they'll find a little area and build a little open nest out of grass and moss and lay their eggs in. And it has to be hidden away, but they'll also nest in almost any crevice, so outside toilets, on top of a cistern, in sheds, in pillar boxes, in people's coat pockets, famously in an unmade bed, in the engine of a plane, in the engine of a Land Rover. You know, they're just looking for a safe place to lay their eggs, you know. That's what's funny about robins. We put all this sort of culture on top of them, so mostly benevolent and some not. But of course, they're just doing what birds do. They're trying to raise a family and they're doing it quickly. Robins live fast and die young, probably only live a year or two mostly. So many of them die before their first birthday, so they have to get going. So they're really just doing what birds do, but we've associated this with so many aspects of our own lives.
The way you describe the robin, its opportunism, the way it cocks its head when it looks at you whilst you're gardening, whilst it's waiting for its worms. I mean, in many ways, and the fact that it can also be very aggressive, but also very friendly seeming, it does seem to have some rather human traits. Do you think that's why we in Britain have taken it quite so close to our hearts, that we see ourselves in the bird?
I think so. I think that's often the case. Having said that, of course, two groups of birds that have very human traits in that they're very clever, they are very opportunistic, are crows and gulls. And we tend to not like crows and gulls, and we particularly don't like them when they move into our territory, so gulls in cities. So I think with the robin, it looks undeniably extremely cute. Those big eyes, the big round head, the plump breast, the red. Male and females, of course, both have a red breast. And even though the red breast is actually a signal of aggression, to us it's a symbol of beauty. So I think really it's that. I think it's because they live alongside us rather than being particularly like us. We got a new Labrador puppy about 4 or 5 months ago called Rosie, and she's a beautiful red fox Labrador, rather almost like an orange robin-y colour, actually, a bit lighter. And one day I was sitting in my office, as I am now, out in the Somerset countryside in my garden, and I had the door open because it was the summer, so this was back in June, July, and suddenly this little bird rushed in, being chased by a very frantic and barking Rosie. And it was a baby robin. It must have been July, because it was just molting. I just had the beginnings of the red breast on the speckled plumage. And luckily, I grabbed it very quickly and very carefully and took it down the garden and released it over the hedge. And it was very happy, because Rosie probably would have made short work of it, because she's quite curious about things like that. That was my sort of embarrassing story. I don't think the others are mostly in the book. There's an awful lot of stuff, as you say, in the book. It was a delight to write. I'm hoping to do the Wren next. You never know if the publishers are listening. And we're hoping, you've asked about an audio book. I've done audio books before. For the two books I did with my friend Brett Westwood, we did Tweet of the Day and we did Wonderland, and they're both available on audio book. And they usually tend to be a bit of an afterthought, sadly, and they're done, you know, after the book's out. So I promise you, I am lobbying for an audiobook of The Robin, partly because it's a lovely short book, so I better read it in a day, but partly because I think people would really enjoy it, and it will be lovely for your listeners to be able to hear it read by my dulcet tones, hopefully.
In the meantime, I've been enjoying it read by my wife and my daughters, both of whom are rather impressed by the feisty female robins.
Absolutely. Quite right.
I also I understand from them that the illustrations and especially the cover art is absolutely beautiful. So I'm sure it'll be finding its way into many a Christmas stocking.
I do hope so. Yeah, it was a lovely book to write. It's always lovely when people have read a book I've written and say to me, well, someone said to me a few years ago, a woman came up and she said, "Oh, I loved your book." She said, "But it was very easy to read." And then she stopped herself and said, "Oh, I'm terribly sorry. That's not the right thing at all to say to a proper nature writer." And I said, "It's a lovely thing to say. Thank you so much, because of course I want it to be easy to read." But the Robin book's very easy to read, you know. I promise you, there's not a lot of heavy science, bit of feminism, as you say, with the feisty females, and, you know, hopefully something for everyone.
Stephen Moss's book, The Robin, A Biography, is out now in print and ebook, and it's flying off the shelves. I'm sure it'll be found nesting under many a tree this Christmas.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Would you like to chat over the telephone with a group of like-minded people? RNIB's award-winning telephone social groups are small, friendly and lots of fun. A great way of making new friends and a chance to socialise without leaving the comfort of your home. Telephone RNIB Talk and Support on 0845 330 3723 or email talkandsupport@rnib.org.uk.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Robert Kirkwood will be plucking some festive tales from the Talking Books Library, and Eddie Izzard tells us all about Lost Christmas. But first, not only is Stephen Scott the host of RNIB Connect Radio's Tech Talk, he also likes to road test the gizmos he features on the show, which makes him the go-to man when choosing a piece of technology that's meant to help with sight loss. With my Daisy machine defunct and my eye-hand coordination making overdrive awkward to use, I wanted to hear about other ways to listen to talking books and other audiobooks, and maybe get some ideas for my Christmas list. The only problem is, I'm not sure who is going to be interviewing whom. Stephen, who's asking the questions?
Oh, I think it's your turn. I do enough talking, quite frankly.
Okay, then. Well, I recently moved from Daisy, and the CDs and big clunky rubber buttons on the machine to downloading my books via my mobile onto OverDrive. And there are pros and cons. There's little tactile feedback, and I believe you feel pretty much the same.
I do. I really do. I miss the old ways. I feel so old by saying that, and I'm not old, but I feel it because I kind of liked the world of tactile. You know, the world when you had things, and, you know, Daisy. Daisy's going away, isn't it? I mean, it's not something that people are using as much anymore. You know, Daisy players that are breaking down, they're not being fixed as easily. And it seems as if the world is moving towards USB or it's moving towards digital downloads. And that's great. And it is great because what it does is it opens up choice and it opens up instant choice. But that ability to be able to, you know, stop a cassette tape and know that when you hit play again, you would pick up where you left off. And, you know, you're not having a voice speak over the top of it, or your phone starts ringing in the middle of it and cuts off the book entirely and you lose your place and your stream of thought. Because, you know, listening to a book isn't just about listening, it's about thinking as well. It's moving towards a new place, and it's a place we do have to get used to. Doesn't mean we've got to like it, though.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I rather like the wireless world of being able to wander around with my phone in my pocket and my headphones on, and I can, you know, prepare the kids' food and so on and so forth. And I was always at the mercy of the ever diminishing battery life on my Daisy machine as far as moving around the house was concerned. But you're right, you know, being interrupted just in the middle of a murder scene by your dad calling up saying, you know, oh, are you still coming down next weekend? Kind of, it takes you away from that relationship with the book. You have to multitask.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I'm doing at the moment is learning Braille. And a lot of people have asked me why. And the question, it comes from sighted people. Some blind people ask it as well. But the reason I think it comes from sighted people is they wonder, as do a lot of people now, ask the question, well, is Braille still relevant? And the question is irrelevant, in my view. The question itself is irrelevant, actually. Of course Braille is as relevant as English, frankly, because it's about understanding the written word. You know, reading a book, for me growing up with enough sight to be able to read a large print book, meant that I was able to understand language and understand how to spell. And spelling was a big thing for me growing up. I had to get it right. And I always remember my gran had gone into hospital when I was, I must have been 5 or 6, and she had an operation. And I remember going into the school and we had a frieze on the wall. I don't know if you remember those at school. We had the big paper on the wall and it had these little folders in it. And every folder had A, B, C, D, E. And I had to go up to each one and pick out the word I was looking for from this. And I was at the letter G. And I'm going through all the words, and the teacher comes up, and I'm frantically searching it. She says, what word is it you're looking for? And I said, gallbladder. And she said, what? And she said, I said, well, my gran's been in for a gallbladder operation, so I need to find the word to know how to spell it. She's like, you're not going to find that in a primary school wall. But, you know, that was me. I was obsessed by getting the words and getting them right. And that meant a lot to me. And what I've found over the past few years, especially I'd say in the last 3-4 years, the ability to read and the ability to read is pretty much gone. But the ability to remember how words look and how words are spelled is going away. And I find that quite annoying.
I agree. Actually, I do think that there is an element of learning through life that you get by looking at words. Part of that's reinforcement of what you know. Part of it's seeing new words. That every so often you'll hear a new phrase coined and you'll just go, oh, sea change, is that capital C?
That's
or
right.
SEA? Or I also think that there is, I have had to learn to listen to audiobooks, and for me it feels very much like writing with my right hand. I'm left-handed. It still doesn't feel 100% natural or right to me. I don't immerse myself in the same way in a book, and I've never considered Braille because my fingers are so mashed up after so much rock climbing. But I will watch your progress with interest, I think.
Well, you know, that's the thing. I mean, Braille isn't for everyone, and I'm not saying Braille's the answer. I really am not. But it's an individual choice, and that's my choice. If it's for you, then great. But for me, I agree. And I think also it comes down to, you know, what's available. You know, if I wanted to get a book tomorrow and listen to it, or just get a book and read it, I'd have to listen to it because that's the only option I've got right now. And I'm not against audiobooks at all. I think audiobooks are fantastic. I signed up to Audible a good while ago, and then R&IB Talking Books became free, and I ditched my Audible subscription because I thought, stuff that, I'm having it for free, thanks. Because I'm Scottish, I have to point that out. And I thought, this is fantastic, and I got access to all these books. And What you can do is you can download the Overdrive app. Now, it's not an RNIB app. It's a company called Overdrive that make this app. And it holds tons. I don't know how many there are on there, but there are tons of libraries of books. And basically, organisations like RNIB add their library into the mix. And then what you do is you select the library, you sign in, you put your password in, your library card number. Quite a lot to remember when you're signing up to it. That's the only thing. But, you know, I guess there's ways and means to do that. You can put that information on a dictaphone. That's what I did, so that I could stay in the screen and do what I had to do and type in the information. And then once you sign into it, you've got access to all these books, and you can search for books based on genre, you can search for books based on title or your favourite author. I wish they did it by narrator. That would be good.
Mm.
Wouldn't that be amazing?
Well, yeah, like they do on the RNIB Library website.
On the yeah, that's right.com. Yeah, you can do it on there. Yep. It's a great platform to find tons of books. I mean, there are thousands, literally thousands of books on there. And that is a great place to go to. And it's a great place to start. So if you've got a smartphone and you just want to dabble, then, you know, get in touch with RNIB, get the library ID, because it's free. You know, you can sign up for free. It doesn't cost anything. There is another way, though. I mean, you mentioned rniblibrary.com, and that's one I've not used very often, I'll be honest. I haven't used it much, because I would tend to think of me listening in on a, probably on a phone, or my other preferred method is by USB stick. So what I do is I get the USBs delivered. I kind of like the USB stick and its little plastic wallet coming through the door. Bump. And there's my book that I can just, I know that I can take away and listen at any point. And what I do is I bought from RNIB a little USB stick player called a Sonic, and it's just fantastic. It's a tiny little device. It's very portable. It's like, you know, you get a lot of these Bluetooth speakers these days, and they're like big blocks that you can listen to, you know, your phone or whatever. You can pair it up with Bluetooth. But with this particular one, the Sonic, you've got a USB stick in the top of it, and there's three buttons. You take your USB stick, you, as I do, always put it in the wrong way around first, then turn it around and put it in the right way, and you've got three buttons: stop, rewind, and fast forward. But as soon as you put the USB in, it starts playing, and it is just incredible. You've got a big knob in the front, which you can turn up when you, there's a very clear click to turn it on, and you can turn the volume up to suit yourself. The sound off is good. I'm going to be honest with you. It ain't a Bose. It ain't a Sonos. it costs £30. So, you know, you'll get what you pay for. But for books, actually, it's pretty good. And what's also quite nice about it is you can pair up with Bluetooth your smartphone or your iPad or even your any other devices you've got that have got Bluetooth on them. You can pair them up. So if you wanted to listen to a podcast or something, then you would be able to do that. You could listen to this program's podcast on that device through your phone. So it's quite clever. And, you know, it's like £30. It's not bad.
One for the Christmas stocking.
It really is. It really, really is.
I genuinely miss curling up with a book and shutting the rest of the world out. And I think that, obviously, I'm delighted that there are as many talking books and audiobooks out there on the market as there are. It makes me incredibly happy to see that more and more books are being simultaneously published in audio and in print. And I think we are about to see the age of the audiobook finally come to fruition. Having been a visual reader, I don't think it will ever feel like the same experience. But actually, knowing that there is a way of separating my phone from my recreational activity of listening to audiobooks, I think I know what is going to be on my Christmas list then. That sounds like a very good tip. I like the idea of just being able to plug in a USB stick and go, rather than have to fiddle around on what, let's face it, on Overdrive is not an interface that's been designed with the visually impaired in mind.
No, it hasn't. And, you know, there's no doubt that they have made strides to make the app accessible. And I think they have, there's more they can always do. And I think, you know, it's on us to some degree, if we find a fault with it, to tell the company, tell RNIB first, I think. Mm. You know, get in touch with RNIB. We say this in Tech Talk all the time. You know, actually, we as blind people, we need to kind of drive the bus on this one, because if there is an accessibility issue, it might not get spotted by the developer because they're not using the Access software. So, you know, we need to tell them. It is on us, and especially if it's something we want to use, like OverDrive is something a lot of people would want to use. But interestingly, you know, I said about USB, and USB is a great way of listening. But there's another way that I've chosen to listen to books most recently, and that was all thanks to the company that starts with the letter A.
Fruity?
No, actually, no.
Oh.
The other one. You're ahead of me.
The South American one.
That's yes, that's right. The one that used to be a forest. This is really interesting because they brought out the Amazon Echo, of course, which was the device that you can talk to. And it's a device that you speak to and it will give you information. So you can ask what the time is, you can ask what the date will be next Tuesday or what the weather is outside, and it's great for all of that. And it's a real leveler when it comes to equality around accessibility and usability by anybody. You know, the same commands that you use are the same commands that a blind person or a fully sighted person uses, or anybody uses, quite frankly. I mean, they even have developed software for people who can't speak, who use computers as a voice, to be able to interact. I mean, talk about leveling the playing field.
Mm.
But the reason I like it is because when you have, and you have to, of course, typically, they want you to buy their services. That's why they make these products. Can't get away from that. That's the world we now live in. But this product that you buy, the Amazon Echo or the Amazon Echo Dot, you can connect it to your Kindle library. Now, if you have, for example, Kindle books, some of them will be able to be read to you like text-to-speech. You know, it'll turn it into text and it'll just read it in a synthetic voice. I'm not a fan of that personally. But if you were to choose to buy an audiobook or subscribe to the Amazon Audible store, which lets you, you know, I think if you pay something like £8 a month, you'll get a download of a book a month or whatever it is, you can then listen to those books via the device. Now, I'll give you an example. I bought the new Hillary Clinton book, What Happened? Brilliant title, by the way.
Yep.
And all I do is say, Alexa, and I apologize if I've set off your device already, but Alexa, play Hillary Clinton's book, What Happened? And it just starts reading it. And it picks up where it left off because it knows. And that's synchronized across your devices. So if you're on your phone, for example, and you start playing on that, it'll play from the last point you left off. So that sort of start-stop cassette tape thing is kind of back with that, but across multiple devices. But I like the voice aspect of it, that you don't have to physically even touch anything or get confused by anything. You don't have to get near a computer. You just talk to it and say, play my book. And if it knows that that's the book you like, you just need to tell it to play your most recent book and it'll just start playing it. I think that is where you said earlier about the age of the audiobook. This will be it. I think this is what will drive it ultimately for everybody, because we need to make all of this technology, no matter what it is, we need to make all of this technology available to everybody, because then if everybody likes it and everybody gets it and everybody buys it, first of all, it becomes cheaper for us, and secondly, it gets continued.
And it improves.
And it improves.
The wrinkles get ironed out.
Yeah.
One final question I have for you is, what have you read recently that you'd recommend to my listeners?
Well, I'm a bit of an old-fashioned type of guy. I was listening to, and you'll hate me for this because you think, why have you never read this before? I was most recently listening to Agatha Christie's 450 from Paddington, which yes. I just adore. And I love anything with trains in it. I'm a bit of a train fan. When The Girl on the Train came out, I was so excited. Anything that happens involving trains, I don't know why, because I wouldn't say I'm a train spotter, I'm not one of them. I don't have the bobble hat and all that, but I do love anything about trains. And throw a bit of murder in there and a bit of Agatha Christie, perfect. So if you haven't tried it, it is in the RNIB library. Do check it out.
Thanks to Stephen Scott. I know what I want for Christmas. I just hope Santa was listening. And if you'd like more information on any of the products we discussed, you can find it by visiting the RNIB online shop. It's at rnib.org.uk, or you can call the helpline on 0303 123 9999, where you'll find a team of experts on hand to give you help and advice.
The season of goodwill and generosity is well and truly upon us, and this Christmas, there's a way of supporting RNIB that won't cost you a penny. Just collect used stamps from your cards and parcels, and we will recycle them into much-needed funds. For full details and to order your collection box and prepaid envelope, visit rnib.org.uk/stamps or call 0141 328 9357 and have a very Merry Christmas.
Join RNIB Connect and become part of a wider and stronger community led by blind and partially sighted people. Membership is free and it's the best way to keep in touch with things that are of interest and help to you. You'll receive Connect Magazine, our monthly membership publication, in your chosen format, as well as having the chance to be amongst thousands of like-minded blind and partially sighted people, friends, families and supporters. You'll also be able to take part in and organise social activities in your area, campaign for change and improve the lives of people with little or no sight, and get help from a dedicated RNIB Connect support team. It couldn't be easier to join RNIB Connect. Simply complete the online form at rnib.org.uk or join over the phone by calling 0303 1234 555.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Still to come on this week's show, Eddie Izzard on narrating a magical Christmas tale. But before that, whether you listen to your audiobooks on Daisy, Overdrive, or via Sovereign Sonic's USB player, Robert Kirkwood has been busy preparing this seasonal selection to get us in the mood for Christmas.
A quick search in the RNIB Talking Books Library will turn up many books about Christmas, some dramas, some kids' stories, and some to help you on the big day. So let's start off with
Women's Institute Complete Christmas. Over 130 recipes for a perfect Christmas. Christmas is the time of year for enjoying the company of family and friends, but this can be lost in the frantic lead-up to the big day. I'm sure we've all said it many times, all this fuss over one day. But it's definitely worth the effort. It can be such a bright and happy time with parties and celebrations and a chance to be hospitable. We can indulge in delicious meals without thinking about calories and have a perfect excuse to decorate our homes both inside and out with festive decorations that would be considered over the top at any other time. It's also a great opportunity to get out the best china and tableware to make all the meals extra special.
The Women's Institute Complete Christmas is packed with over 130 fail-safe recipes and ideas for Christmas, from traditional favourites such as butter roast turkey with chestnut stuffing or other festive favourites. And staying in a traditional Christmas mood, here's some Christmas stories by Charles Dickens.
I have been looking on this evening at a merry company of children assembled round that pretty German toy, a Christmas tree. The tree was planted in the middle of a great round table and towered high above their heads. It was brilliantly lighted by a multitude of little tapers, and everywhere sparkled and glittered with bright objects. There were jolly, broad-faced little men, much more agreeable in appearance than many real men, and no wonder, for their heads took off and showed them to be full of sugar plums. There were rosy-cheeked dolls hiding behind the green leaves, and there were real watches, with movable hands at least, and an endless capacity of being wound up, dangling from innumerable twigs.
So he wrote more than A Christmas Carol. This is a collection of short stories written by Dickens, sometimes alone, sometimes in collaboration with Wilkie Collins, for the Christmas numbers of magazines to which he contributed. Now let's bring things a little more up to date. R.D. Wingfield's Frost at Christmas.
10 days to Christmas, and Tracy Uphill, aged 8, hasn't come home from Sunday school. Enter D.I. Jack Frost, sloppy, scruffy, and insubordinate. To help him investigate the case of the missing child, Frost has been assigned a new sidekick, the chief constable's nephew. fresh to Provincial Denton in an oversmart suit. D.C. Clive Barnard is an easy target for Frost's withering satire. Assisted and annoyed by Barnard, Frost proceeds with the investigation in typically unorthodox style.
R.D. Wingfield's Frost at Christmas, a wee bit more grown up, that one. And also, more crime at Christmas with the invasion of the Christmas puddings.
The Death Pudding. Doo-doo-doo-doo-doom. Father Christmas flung the rocket sleigh into a handbrake turn and accelerated hard, but it was useless. The Death Pudding had caught the little sleigh in its extra sticky, sticky matter traction beam and was relentlessly reeling in the rocket. A gaping mouth appeared among the flames on the surface of the Death Pudding as the rocket was sucked inside. As the mouth began to close back down, Father Christmas, peering fearfully from his sleigh, saw what he had most feared all his life. His big, bad brother.
Father Christmas's evil brother, Bad Christmas, is plotting to turn everyone on the planet into zombies using Christmas puddings. The Invasion of the Christmas Puddings by Jeremy Strong is available from RNIB Overdrive. And staying with Christmas puddings, how about The Adventure of the Christmas Pudding with Hercule Poirot?
Hercule Poirot entered his bedroom. It was a large room, well provided with radiators. As he went over towards the big four-poster bed, he noticed an envelope lying on his pillow. He opened it and drew out a piece of paper. On it was a shakily printed message in capital letters. Don't eat none of the plum pudding. One as wishes you well. Hercule Poirot stared at it. His eyebrows rose. Cryptic, he murmured, and most unexpected.
The Adventure of the Christmas Pudding and a selection of other entrees by Agatha Christie is available in various formats from RNIB. But from murderers at the Christmas table to someone with a heart two sizes too small, here's the meanest creature you'll ever meet.
How the Grinch Stole Christmas by Dr. Seuss. Every Who down in Whoville liked Christmas a lot. But the Grinch, who lived just north of Whoville, did not. The Grinch hated Christmas, the whole Christmas season. Now please don't ask why. No one quite knows the reason. It could be his head wasn't screwed on just right. It could be, perhaps, that his shoes were too tight. But I think that the most likely reason of all may have been that his heart was two sizes too small.
The disgruntled Grinch hatches a dastardly plan to steal Christmas from the citizens of Whoville. This short story is available from RNIB Overdrive and in various formats from the National Library Service. Now here's an unusual one you may not have heard of. You'll certainly have heard of the author famous for The Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings trilogy. But J.R.R. Tolkien also wrote some Father Christmas letters.
1928. What do you think the poor dear old bear has been and done this time? Nothing as bad as letting off all the lights. Only fell from top to bottom of the main stairs on Thursday. We were beginning to get the first lot of parcels down out of the storerooms into the hall. Polar Bear would insist on taking an enormous pile on his head, as well as a whole lot in his arms.
Written by J.R.R. Tolkien to his children, the Father Christmas letters are available from RNIB Overdrive and in various formats from RNIB's National Library Service. Also, why not try some cat tails for Christmas?
Cat tails for Christmas. What a cosy image. A full moon outside, not a footprint in the snow, the doors well sealed and every window pane rimmed with frost. Beneath the dark oak beams, a quiet figure sits by a log fire. A grandfather clock chimes a late hour, and all eyes look up as she begins to read. At her feet, blinking in the gloaming and purring contentedly as the aged voice unfolds the story, lies the household cat, smiling a quiet approval.
Some vintage, some contemporary cat tales by various authors, available from RNIB. As are these general stories for Christmas.
Stories for Christmas by Alf Prazan. High up on the hillside stood a little town all by itself. The people who lived there were exactly like other people in other towns. Some were tall and some were small. Some were hard-working and some were lazy. Some liked fish cakes better than meatballs, and some liked meatballs better than fish cakes. So there were a few differences between them. But in one respect, they were all alike. They were terribly forgetful, and they forgot the most extraordinary things all at the same time.
By Alf Prosen, the stories for Christmas comprise a number of festive tales, like the one where it's Christmas Eve and the whole town had forgotten. Then a little girl looked up at the fir trees in the forest and begins to remember. And finally, Dylan Thomas's A Child's Christmas in Wales.
One Christmas was so much like another in those years around the sea town corner now, and out of all sound, except the distant speaking of voices I sometimes hear a moment before sleep, that I can never remember whether it snowed for 6 days and 6 nights when I was 12, or whether it snowed for 12 days and 12 nights when I was 6. All the Christmases rolled down toward the two-tongued sea like a cold and headlong moon bundling down the sky that was our street, and they stop at the rim of the ice-edged, fish-freezing waves, and I plunge my hand into the snow and bring out whatever I can find.
The Talking Book Service from RNIB is free and easy to join. Head to www.rnib.org.uk and click on Talking Books.
Eddie Izzard is an award-winning comedian who's also turned his talents to writing, extreme marathon running, acting and voice acting. But it was a Christmas connection that led him to becoming an audiobook narrator, as he told Robert Kirkwood.
Thanks, Red. Eddie Izzard has recently recorded the audio version of Believe Me, his memoir, and he read it in his own unique style.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Believe Me, a memoir of love, death, and jazz chickens. This is the author, Eddie Izzard. Welcome to Believe Me, the audiobook. Yes, this is a memoir of love, death, and jazz chickens. Chickens that actually play jazz. So this is not me reading the book. Keith Richards is reading the book. Just in my style, that's what he's doing. So I am actually Keith Richards, audiobooking this book. Anyway, no, it's me doing it. No, this is Kenneth Dunwoody. No, this is Jack Chirac. Hi, I'm Jack Chirac. I'm just popped over from France. I'm Jack Chirac, and I've just popped over to do this thing. I'll read this whole scene. Anyway, I'm reading me an autobiography now.
In places very different from the print version, that's Eddie Izzard reading from his memoir, Believe Me. That's only the second audiobook that Eddie Izzard has ever recorded. The first was a festive treat called Lost Christmas.
Forward. I started filming Lost Christmas in Manchester in March 2011, after having just finished filming Treasure Island in Puerto Rico. Filming the role of Long John Silver in Treasure Island, and then, 2 weeks later, the role of Anthony in Lost Christmas was a challenging opportunity and a drastic weather change. But I'd spent years trying to get roles like these. The film story and the book story of Lost Christmas are slightly different, and I hope they will give people the same overall feeling, that it's always good to hear a tale about a little magic at Christmas. Anthony is a character who knows no fear. He can't feel fears, he's lost all his memory, and this gives him a magical quality. He knows he has a mission, but has no idea what that mission is.
He recorded part of the book at the RNIB Talking Book Studios in Glasgow, and when he was there, I asked him why he wanted to narrate a book.
It's interesting, because I've been thinking of doing a talking book for ages, because my grandfather read all the works of Dickens endlessly, and I'm born exactly 150 years after Charles Dickens. And his stuff is quite different to what I do, but also crosses over because it is comical, but it's also very dramatic. It's a place where I'm trying to get to. So I just thought, and also I'm a bad reader, I'm dyslexic, so I'm a slow reader. And a great way to read, have to read a book, is if you do an audiobook. It's because you have to go through the whole thing. I thought it could take forever to do, and it has taken quite a long time. And some days I can't get my teeth in right, and it just, the words are going backwards and forwards. But it's been good. It's quite emotional as well. So Lost Christmas is a film that I, and this is quite unusual. I don't know if they normally do this, but it's a film that we did. Dave Logan and John Hay, the director. Dave Logan was the writer with John Hay, the director, and they wrote the screenplay. And then Dave Logan has adapted the book from that came out last year, and this is the audiobook of it. So I'm trying to keep certain consistencies with certain actors in there. Certain things are slightly different because the story is slightly different to the film. And I'm trying to keep my role as similar to the way I did it, even though I'm saying somewhat different things. So trying to get all that lining up is a little tricky. And also I'm doing certain accents and I'm not brilliant at accents. I'm quite good at certain accents and other ones. Then there's supposed to be an Indian Mancunian accent in there, which I just thought I can't land that one. Or maybe I can now. I don't know. Maybe we'll have to see. So anyway, it's tricky, but I wanted to see what it was like, and now I want to do more.
Now, you're used to acting and, of course, performance, stand-up in huge arenas. How does the performance differ when you're essentially reading to one person?
Yes, well, that's how I do stand-up. So if that's the same, I mean, yes, that is true. Whereas in a film and a theatre, it's a bit different. So definitely when I'm doing stand-up, you're just performing as if the whole audience is one person. And so that is a similar thing. And then the rest of it, because it's interesting, is you've got all the stage directions, and then he went down, he looked down the road, he looked at the house, it was big, it was small. Those things, you can get caught up with those, especially when things start getting fast, because then I noticed that the story starts really picking up, because you're getting into, so he ran down the road, looked behind, they were catching up on him, he had to move on, and your whole pace speeds up, but you have to try and articulate correctly, and I have a bad articulation, and I thought this might actually help me get better at articulation, because I do tend to mumble words for a whole problem I had in my teenage years when no one would listen to me, so I started mumbling.
Now, you mentioned you'd like to do more books. What would your ideal book be to narrate?
Christmas Carol.
Now, that's more of a one-man show than a book. Would you go for it with all the accents?
I do like accents. I'm not. Some people are brilliant at accents. I hear loads of noises going through my head. So, but if you put accents and different voices into characters, I mean, that's where I came from in sketch comedy before I was a stand-up. So if you're playing someone who's talking like that, and then you're playing someone who's talking like that, and I used to do that in pure comedy. But to do it in a dramatic comedy or in pure drama, to move between those, and to actually to get emotion into it, as opposed to what in stand-up I do is pure comedy. That is a good thing, and also once you've done it, it does stick around for the rest, maybe of eternity, in a way, which sounds a bit silly, but you know, you can do these things, and you know, people, they can store stuff on databases, and it'd be quite nice, you know, just to be another 50 years on and listen back to, oh, there, that's when I was 50, that'll be 100 at that point.
No, that's very true. On the Talking Book Show, I've been lucky enough to be granted access to RNIB's audio library, and there are books in there well over 50 years old. Still clear as a bell, though, but by people like Peter Cushing, Joyce Grenfell, Laurence Olivier, they last forever.
Yeah. No, that is a nice thing. And also, it doesn't cost much to do them, doesn't cost much people to get them. And also, if somebody hears something like on a radio, they can hopefully, I don't know when this is going out, but at some point someone might listen to this and say, oh, I want to get that. And they press a button, Lost Christmas, put my name in maybe, and it'll be there. And then they can press download, and they can download it. I mean, audiobooks probably take, you know, like 2 minutes to download. Mm. Actual books take 30 seconds to download. I downloaded one on a plane just before we started taxiing off. It's like, poof, just hit the button. And that's all those words going down. But, yeah, they're easy and quick to download.
Oh, back in the day, now this is RNIB, as there wasn't such a thing as commercial audiobooks, but you used to order your books by letter, and in return you got a box of records. And then, of course, in the 70s, that box of records became a box of cassettes.
Yes, yes. Now I remember. There was a David Davis, I think, recorded. Was it Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit? I think it might be Lord of the Rings, and we recorded them all off. Me and my brother recorded them all off Radio 4 onto cassettes in the 70s, but we missed a few bits, and my brother went on and recorded the thing, and they said, now back to the studio with David Davis. And so I've got my brother's voice is on that, probably of age about 14 or 12 or somewhere around that. So that is a good thing. That's a great thing to have. We've got to actually dig those up again.
He took hold of Anthony's hand, and as the skin touched skin, Anthony drew in a sharp breath. This time the sensation was even more violent. It felt as if Anthony's arm was being clamped in solid metal. The feeling spread up past his elbow, over his shoulder, and then penetrated him, burrowing into his armpit, like the root of an iron tree frantically searching out sustenance. The worm-like root drilled into him, through his chest, and then launched skywards, snaking up his throat until it reached the centre of his brain. Everything went black.
Lost Christmas will be available on audio from Audio Go later in the year. Now, it's a lovely story, but what do you think brought it closest to you? Narrating the book or being in the film?
For the whole narrative, reading the book, then you're enveloping the whole story. For me, playing Anthony was a wonderful thing. But that was me, and I'm in charge of all of where he's going, and then everyone else reacts to me, and I react to what they're, you know, it's all our interactions. So, but for the whole story, to get it, it's reading the book, but then I can watch the film and also get it there. So I do like the film. I do think it's the best work I've done.
Now, will you listen to it again? Because a lot of narrators say it takes them about a year and a half before they can enjoy it as a story and not see it as a piece of work.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, I want to hear it fairly soon just to hear what it sounds like, because I can't... I want to hear that what I was thinking was going into it wasn't. And sometimes you hear mistakes and you do the line again, but there must be a few mistakes in there that go, ooh, that sounds just a bit weird. But, yeah, we shall see.
Eddie Izzard, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much.
The audio versions of Believe Me, the memoir by Eddie Izzard, and Lost Christmas are available commercially now.
Thanks, Robert. Alas, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and everyone who's been in touch. You can do so too by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.